The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizesa. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, President-elect Donald Trump and the emergency powers that he says he would claim to carry out mass deportations. What are the limits? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies.
But U.S. border policy is poised to undergo a dramatic transformation once President-elect Donald Trump takes office in January.
We must use any and all resources needed to stop the invasion, including moving thousands of troops currently stationed overseas.
And U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has confirmed he is prepared to declare a national state of emergency as part of a mass deportation of migrants.
There are a lot of questions about what Donald Trump can and cannot do if he does follow through on his promise to declare illegal immigration a national emergency. While a national emergency declaration does give a president additional powers, these powers are not absolute. However, Trump and his acolytes have gone on the record claiming that they will do things that will push these powers beyond what the law has allowed in the past. Many expect there will be legal battles as Trump will seek to make good on his promise of mass deportations using the military. I spoke with national expert on presidential powers Elizabeth Goitein about this. At the Brenham Center for Justice, she just published how Trump could deploy the military for mass deportation, breaking down the laws the president could use to facilitate mass deportations, including the Insurrection Act and the Alien Enemies Act. And she points out where the deployment of the military in mass deportations might run afoul and be vulnerable to legal challenges.
Well, it's really hard to know. And the reason for that is because what this administration wants to do, and we know this because they've told us this, is to throw so many things out there that it's sort of impossible for people to sort of catch their breath and figure out which leads to pursue. And so we're doing a little bit of shadow boxing right now, the people who are sort of observing Trump's comments and trying to prepare for what might happen in the next administration. Because, you know, Trump has said that he's going to declare a national emergency, but he hasn't said what powers he will invoke. So the way the National Emergencies Act works is that the president is authorized to declare a national emergency. He has a lot of discretion to do that. And then that declaration unlocks powers that are included in 150 different provisions of law. And I will say that none of those provisions is designed to facilitate deportation. So they're all going to be a little bit indirect, right? And so trying to figure out which of the particular powers he wants to invoke is a bit of a tea leaf reading exercise that people are doing right now. Same with the Insurrection Act. So he has said that he will invoke the Insurrection Act. The Insurrection Act gives the president broad powers to deploy federal armed forces to quell civil unrest or to enforce the law. It is the primary exception to the Posse Comitatus Act, which is the general rule that federal armed forces do not participate in domestic civilian law enforcement activities. Under the Insurrection Act, they can. But he hasn't said how he's going to use them. And that is key because under existing law, without any Insurrection Act declaration, there is actually a lot of things that the federal military can do and that the National Guard can do to support the activities of DHS, whether it's border security or other immigration enforcement mechanisms. So it's certainly possible that Trump is going to invoke the Insurrection Act because for the effect, for the optics, the symbolic effect, and that it's really going to be about shock and awe and not, you know, he doesn't actually need to use any of the authorities under that law. But at the most extreme, and I think this is sort of what you're getting at, how far could he go? He could use the Insurrection Act to deploy federal armed forces into any state in the country, even over the governor's objections, to directly engage in immigration enforcement activities, up to and including apprehension and detention of immigrants. And that is really something that he wouldn't be able to do without an Insurrection Act invocation. But really, there's a lot of guesswork going on right now, because I think the incoming administration has been deliberately not very specific about its plans.
But he has been clear, saying he's going to declare a national emergency.
Yes, and I think he will do that probably on day one. He declared a national emergency in his first administration at the southern border, and he used that declaration to invoke a power that allows the president to reprogram military construction project funding. So he can essentially take the funding for one military construction project and move it to a different one. He used that to fund the building of the border wall at the southern border after Congress refused to allocate the funding that he had requested. So that is something he could do again. He could do literally the same thing. All of this went up through the courts in his first administration. But when President Biden took office and terminated that emergency declaration, the Supreme Court vacated all of the decisions below. So it's like we're starting from scratch again, right? So he could do that. He could rely on that same power to try to get funding to construct detention facilities for immigrants, to have the military construct those facilities. Now, I think there's a very good legal argument that those facilities would not be being built to support the military, and that is something that is required under that particular emergency power. But that is something he might try to do. So yes, I definitely expect to see a national emergency declaration. That is a very easy thing to do. It just requires the president's signature on a proclamation. It's been done more than 70 times since the National Emergencies Act was enacted in 1976. It does not necessarily carry the same political costs as an Insurrection Act invocation. So I expect to see that happen quite soon in the administration.
All right, we're under over 30 national emergencies right now, including one that Jimmy Carter signed for against Iran during the hostage crisis. I mean, we're in a lot of national emergencies.
It's more than 40 at this point, actually. They keep building up. So there are more than 40 states of emergency right now. And I think most Americans, if you ask them, wouldn't be able to identify 43 national emergencies that are happening right now.
Yeah. This would be a completely different. And so when he says we have a national emergency in the United States, I need extraordinary powers in order to preserve the union. I look out my window. I live in San Antonio, Texas, not that far from the border. Also spend a lot of time actually on the border. And I look out the window there and I don't see chaos. I don't see riots. I don't see turmoil. I see law and order. Is there anyone who can say, you know, this is not really a national emergency. This is just kabuki theater?
That's a little hard to do because the National Emergencies Act doesn't define emergency and it doesn't include any substantive criteria for the president to declare emergency. Now, you know, the word has a definition. There's a dictionary definition that you could go to. But I still think that most courts are going to be reluctant to say, no, the president's wrong. There's not an emergency or just to wade into that aspect of it. But importantly, what courts do look at, what they will look at, is whether the president's actions after he declares the emergency are authorized by the particular emergency power that he chooses to invoke. And so as recently as last year, for example, the Supreme Court struck down President Biden's use of an emergency power to forgive student loan debt, not because there was no emergency. The emergency in that case was COVID. This happened under the COVID declaration, but because that particular power was not, according to the Supreme Court, did not authorize forgiveness of student loan debt. And as I said before, there was litigation when President Trump first tried to use emergency powers to build the border wall, to secure funding for the border wall. And some courts said, no, that's not a proper use of this emergency power, or there were other provisions of law that it overstepped. So courts can review this. They will review this. I think they're unlikely to say there's no emergency here, but there will be other bases on which courts can intervene.
But Congress plays no role in trying to oversight?
Unfortunately not. So the original National Emergencies Act had a provision that allowed Congress to terminate a national emergency declaration using a legislative veto, which is a law that goes into effect with a simple majority vote in both chambers and without the president's signature. So that was what the law looked like originally. In 1983, the Supreme Court held that these legislative vetoes are unconstitutional. So today, if Congress wants to terminate a national emergency declaration, it basically has to pass a law by a veto-proof supermajority of both houses, because Congress can expect that the president will veto it. And that is almost impossible to do given the polarized political environment that we're in today.
I want to go back to when you mentioned about the camps that we're hearing about. Stephen Miller, the advisor for President Trump, who has also been a hard hawk on immigration. He has said that there will be the use of these emergency powers in order to take military dollars to fund the building of these internment camps, deportation camps. This is also a power that was used to create the internment camps for Japanese citizens and German citizens and other people during World War II, American citizens, I should say, also. You know, the building these camps, I mean, the optics on that, I just can't see how that would be a popular idea. But these camps, apparently the constraint that Trump had during his first term is they didn't have enough places to keep all the migrants that they wanted to deport. So what do you see as, you know, what's going to happen with these internment camps?
Right. So there's two separate authorities that you were talking about there. There's the emergency power that Trump could use to try to get the funding to build detention facilities for immigrants. I think that would be a misuse of that particular emergency power, because that particular power comes into play when there is an emergency that requires the use of the military in order to address that emergency. And, you know, that's something that courts might not want to sort of second guess the president on. But the military construction project has to be used to support that deployment of the military. There's really no way in which. So, for example, building military base, if there were an overseas deployment and military bases had to be built in order for the troops to have a place to stay while they were overseas or a home base. That would be an example of a military construction project to support the deployment. In this case, it's not supporting the deployment. The deployment is to support building the facilities. It's the opposite. So I don't think that would be a legal use of that power. Now, you mentioned a different power, which is the Alien Enemies Act. That's not really for building facilities. That is a wartime authority that allows the president during a declared war or when the president proclaims that there is an invasion or a predatory incursion. Then it allows the president to summarily, that means without any process, without any hearings, detain and deport people who are not U.S. citizens, but who were born in the enemy nation or enemy nations, even if that person is in the country lawfully.
So now if this was written, I would be taking my highlighter and be going over that part you just said, because I think that's very important.
It's very important. The two things that invoking the Alien Enemies Act, which Trump has said he will do that too. So the two things that gets him are, first of all, the ability to just dispense with due process entirely, dispense with all these hearings. And the second thing it gets him is the ability to go after green card holders and people who are lawfully in this country. Now, in order to do that, and by the way, the detention camps in World War II were under the Alien Enemies Act. That was the last time this power was used. It was used to detain, I should say, non-U.S. citizens, but people of Japanese, Italian, and German descent.
But there were U.S. citizens, children.
It was a different authority that was used for that.
But there were children. There were U.S. citizens in these camps.
Absolutely. There were mistakes made, and there were also U.S. citizen children who, of course, you know, young children who, rather than be separated from their parents, were put in the camps with the parents. So there were absolutely U.S. citizens who were interned under this authority. Now, in order to even use this authority, President Trump has to proclaim an invasion or predatory incursion by, and I don't know if I said this part before, the invasion has to be by a foreign nation or government. And so he has to say that migration over the southern border is an invasion. And he would basically have to pretend, and this is what his aides has said he will do, that they will say that the drug cartels that operate in Mexico and a couple of other countries south of the border, that those drug cartels are operating as de facto governments
right.
in those regions.
They say frequently that Mexico is a failed state, that it has lost its sovereignty to the drug cartels.
Right. So this would be the law has never been applied in this way. It has never been understood in this way. And in fact, the text of the law, its design, its history, all make very, very clear. This is a wartime authority only. It is meant to address armed attacks by foreign powers, not migrants coming over the border because they're fleeing, you know, persecution or they're seeking economic opportunity or it is not meant to address it. And frankly, you know, even to the extent that some of the people coming over the border may turn out to commit crimes in this country, that's not an act of war. So we would certainly argue strongly at the Brennan Center that would be an illegal use of.
Yeah, but if you are a consumer of right-wing media claiming that what we are witnessing at the southern border is an invasion is something that you would hear multiple times on the air. This is something that they say. I mean, I have been told that myself, that this is an invasion, but right. this is not something that is done. That has no political agenda. These people have no attempt. They don't want to overthrow the state. They just want to find jobs.
Yes, they're using the term invasion rhetorically, to be clear. And I guess, I mean, you can argue about, you know, who's coming over the border and what they're trying to do. What you can't argue is that a rhetorical invasion does not constitute an armed attack by a foreign power.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. National expert on presidential powers, Elizabeth Goitein, is explaining what the law allows a president to do if he declares illegal immigration a national emergency and attempts to use the U.S. military for mass deportation.
Here I am. I'm going to make a prediction. They are going to try and call this an invasion and justify, based on my experience, my opinion, this is what they're going to try to do. And who's going to tell them, no, you're wrong?
Well, there are going to be legal battles, just as there were under the first Trump administration. And I should say, I think, and I should be careful, but I'm pretty sure that the Trump administration lost more cases in court than average. and that was including judges that he appointed. So I think, you know, there is a sense that he is going to sort of pack the bench with judges who will do exactly what he wants them to. He may try to do that. My guess is he was trying to do that during the first administration. It didn't work. So I don't think we should give up on the rule of law entirely. I think there will be legal battles. And one of the things that I think might actually be helpful in these legal battles is that knowing Trump and the people he's appointing, their track record, his track record from his first administration, what he's promised for this administration, he is going to overstep. He is going to stretch even these incredibly broad laws absolutely to their limits and then beyond those limits. And I think that kind of overreach is what's going to maybe get some of the courts to find that he has just gone too far. If he were to try to invoke one of these laws and do something fairly minimalist under that law, you know, that would be a different story. You know, but certainly under the Alien Enemies Act, if he invokes that and he starts trying to deport people who have been lawfully in this country for decades, I think that's going to give judges pause, no matter what their political leanings are. It's just such an abuse of the law.
But if he declares this an invasion, a threat to national security, if he declares war, he now has war powers, and how does that change things?
But he doesn't have war powers if we're not at war. He can't just declare war and make it so. One of the things I worry about when I talk about emergency powers, because for many years now, I've been trying to warn people that these powers are too broad, that there are not enough checks and balances built into the powers that Congress has delegated, that presidents are claiming these broad constitutional powers that don't exist. And one of the things that I'm a little worried about is that there's a big difference between powers that are broader than they should be and powers that authorize literally anything. And I think there's a perception sometimes when I hear conversations about what Trump might do, that if he says the words national security or if he declares an emergency, that the rule of law falls aside and that he can do what he wants, anything he wants. That is not the system we have in this country, thank goodness. And there are many countries where the constitutions of those countries, most countries, the constitutions have separate rules that apply in emergencies, and the constitutions allow the president to suspend some or all of the rights that the people have in an emergency. Our constitution does not have that. The president has only the powers that Congress has chosen to give him to deal with emergencies, and those powers are finite. Now, they are too broad. They don't have checks that they should have in them. But they are finite, and there are things the president cannot do under those powers. And one thing that he can't do is say that there's an invasion and make it so just because he said it.
So here in Texas, we have a Republican governor who's very happy to support Donald Trump in this plan. We have Operation Lone Star, which is an $11 billion initiative to secure the border. We have the General Land Office of Texas, which is providing hundreds of acres, maybe even more, for Trump's camps, internment camps, if he wants to use them. I mean, this is a state that really wants to go along with this plan. So because Texas can invite the Trump to do things in this state, does that change things?
It changes things under some authorities because, for example, the National Guard can operate in three different statuses. The National Guard is usually a creature of state law, a state entity, and it performs state functions paid by state funds. It is under the command and control of the governor of the state. Then there is, on the other side of the spectrum, National Guard forces can be federalized, in which case they are performing federal missions, they're paid by federal funds, and they are under the command and control of the president of the United States until they're returned to state status. And then in between, there's something called Title 32 status, where the National Guard can perform a federal mission paid by federal funds that is requested by the president, but they are still, at least technically, under the command and control of the state governor. Now, why this matters is because the Posse Comitatus Act, which is the law that usually generally prohibits federal armed forces from participating in domestic law enforcement activities, that only applies to the National Guard when it's been federalized. But when you have this intermediate hybrid status, because the Guard is nominally under the state's command and control, the Posse Comitatus Act doesn't apply, even though the president is the one who's defining the mission and the federal government is paying for it. That is a situation where a governor can sort of invite, can offer his or her National Guard troops to follow a federal mission such as immigration enforcement and get reimbursed for it. In a state where the governor does not want the federal government to come in or does not want to use his or her National Guard troops as to perform immigration enforcement activities. In order to do that, then the president would have to invoke the Insurrection Act to federalize the Guard, right? But the president doesn't have to do that in Texas because the governor is willing to use his National Guard for that purpose. So in some senses, yes, it allows, it makes it easier, I would say, for federal armed forces to go into that state and participate in law enforcement activities. It's not necessary, though, because the president can invoke the Insurrection Act to get around it and to deploy against the objections of a state governor.
Can the president do things with militias in order to enforce immigration law?
Are you talking about private militias?
I don't know. I mean, it's a jump.
The Insurrection Act. Right. So the Insurrection Act uses the word militia. The modern incarnation of the state militias that existed at the founding is the National Guard. But under laws that Congress has passed, they are considered the organized militia, the National Guard. The definition of militia in the law includes organized and unorganized militia. And the unorganized militia, just to paraphrase, it's slightly longer, but it's basically able-bodied males between the ages of 17 and 45. So that's a lot of people. So the Insurrection Act does say that the president can call up the militia. The issue here is that at all times, the militia has to be operating under the command and control of the president and needs to be part of those command structures. There's a way to call up the unorganized militia, and it's basically through the draft. And at that point, they become incorporated into, the regular active duty armed forces. Short of that, though, right now there is no structure in which to bring private militias, private individuals into the command structure that they would have to be a part of. And so even though the Insurrection Act kind of seems like it authorizes this, I think in practice, it couldn't be done in a legal way. That's my sense. This is totally untested, I should say. The president has never, presidents have never under the Insurrection Act tried to sort of deputize, private citizens to act as the federal military.
What should people who are in the country, who are non-citizens, what should they be make of all this?
Well, I think, again, they should. I'm sure it must be a very frightening time, especially I'm thinking about, people I know who I'm close with who are here in the country on temporary protected status, right? So they're here in this lawful status that Trump has said he's going to take away. And what is going to happen to them at that point? And I'm sure they're frightened. To some degree, there's the president has... There's prosecutorial discretion involved in these choices about whom to focus on, whom to deport. President Biden, as a policy matter, chose to focus on people who have committed serious crimes in this country. Trump is set to withdraw that guidance, and to not because he doesn't want to focus on those people, but because he wants to focus on everyone, I think. So at some point, it would be silly to tell those people, don't be afraid, you'll be fine. I think a lot of people are going to be deported. But when it comes to some of these extreme measures, detaining and deporting people who are lawfully in this country, when it comes to prolonged military detention, that's something that I think would violate the Constitution and would not be something that the president could do under emergency powers or anything else. There are legal limits, and there are a lot of people who will be looking to make sure that the president doesn't overstep those limits and to hold him accountable and to put a stop to his actions if he does.
Any chance that the president will have the power? He says he's going to do it, sign an executive order on day one to end birthright citizenship.
That's a constitutional question, constitutionally, it has long been understood that people who are born in this country are citizens of this country under our Constitution. And so that if he did that, I think that would go very quickly to the Supreme Court. It's very hard to predict what the Supreme Court would do in almost any case these days. But I think that one is one that the courts would find that he had gone too far.
Elizabeth Guiteen is Senior Director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brenham Center for Justice. She has just published How Trump Could Deploy the Military for Mass Deportation. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters at tpr.org, and you can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.